Okay, so today, though, finishing the work for this particular term on psychoanalysis, the stuff that you have in your mind but you don't know, it's the kind of what Donald Rumsfeld might have called the unknown knowns combined with the unknown unknowns, the stuff in your unconscious. Psychoanalysis, I'm going to talk about under two main headings and then a third heading. First heading is going to be Freud and hermeneutics, fancy word for interpretation. Secondly, I'll talk about Jacques Lacan and linguistics, structureless linguistics in relation to psychoanalysis, which was the kind of turn that Lacan made. And thirdly, I'm going to talk about the case of a particular literary critic who made a very, very complex structure of the history of literature and indeed the history of criticism based upon a particular kind of psychoanalytic thinking, and that's the work of Harold Bloom, BLWM, not to be confused with Alan Bloom, who's a neoconservative kind of common cultural commentator in the United States. Harold Bloom, a very eminent literary critic, and here the key word for Bloom was the notion of influence, and you find out why that becomes important when I speak a little bit about Freud and Lacan. On the board also, there's a couple of other terms that I'll use. Parapraxis, which is a technical term that we understand as a slip of the tongue or a slip of the pen. Then at the far side of the board, you'll see a reference back to the work of Roman Jakobson, Cast Your Mind Back to Russian Formalism, or after the lecture, Cast Your Notes Back to Russian Formalism. Remember Jakobson, and I'll talk about condensation and displacement. On this side of the board here, all of that stuff over there you can ignore. That's from the previous lecture, and I don't quite understand it myself, although it looks very interesting. It has to do with physics and gravity and so on. And maybe I should talk about it, but it looks interesting. But it's nothing to do with what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about this little bit here, the relation between dream thoughts and dream contents. And in the middle, this thing called the dream work, which is based upon condensation and displacement. But I'll get to that in a short time. Psychoanalysis starts from the premise that not everything is apparent. Not everything is available immediately to consciousness. We have an unconscious which runs alongside para, alongside the consciousness. And this unconscious, running alongside, under, above, below, around the consciousness, this unconscious threatens to disrupt the operations of the consciousness and to disrupt what we normally think of as the normality of consciousness. In other words, with this unconscious posited, we can no longer be sure that we know what we know. For our consciousness, the very fact of our consciousness, is built upon a dark area of that which we do not know, that of which we are unconscious. The conscious bit of your mind, the stuff that you know, is surrounded by and indeed built upon, you might even say predicated upon, the unconscious that is lying there as the foundations of the consciousness as such. The consciousness, paradoxically therefore, depends upon the unconscious for its operations. At one level, the unconscious is much more important than the conscious level of our mind and our mental operations. While Marxism traced oppression, particularly in the form of class oppression, it might be suggested that psychoanalysis follows the traces of repressions, not oppression this time, but repressions. There are some variant models of psychoanalytic theory, and I'm going to speak today about two of them in particular. I'll also at one point make a reference back to the feminism lecture, if I can get there, to talk about Kristeva in relation to psychoanalysis. You remember when I talked about Kristeva last week, I hinted about the importance of the psychoanalytic in her work, and I'm going to come back to that if I have time to do so today. Okay, so first up, Freud and hermeneutic. It was Freud who first coined the term psychoanalysis. In 1896, when he started using it, it meant the attempt to uncover what had been repressed and to bring it to verbal articulation. In 1896, it meant something that he, another phrase that he used to describe the practice of psychoanalysis, he called it the talking cure. The patient cured herself or himself by talking with the analyst. If any of you have ever actually gone through psychoanalysis, you'll know that if you've worked with a Freudian analyst, she or he won't actually tell you very much. they'll do a hell of a lot of listening, and they'll kind of encourage you to talk. And gradually, the process is supposed to be one where you come to cure yourself of your own ailments, your neurosis, your psychosis, whatever it is that's afflicting you, through the process of bringing things to consciousness through the activity of talking. So she or he, as an analyst, will simply kind of prod you in directions to be revealing things to yourself through the talking that you do. It's the talking cure. Freud starts from the fact that there are drives and desires that shape our social being, our mental being. These desires, however, cannot always be satisfied. We talked about this way back at the beginning of this whole series of lectures. If your desires cannot be satisfied, it follows that there is and there must be repression of desire as a condition of our civilization or our social being. When I talked about this before, I talked about how it's the case that my desire might clash with yours. I see you walking along the street. I want you. You don't particularly want me. At that point, we have a clash or conflict of desires. How do we resolve that? Well, we resolve it by me learning to repress my desire, because if I don't repress my desire, you're going to be in a little bit of trouble. I'm going to attack you, essentially. Or I'm going to make a move towards you that looks like an attack, and you will construe it as an attack. And that's not a very healthy way to have a society. So in order to be a social being with you, I won't enact my desire immediately. I'll go kind of round about the houses. I'll kind of maybe do that thing where you stand in front of somebody and you can't quite get by, and you know they're going to move to their left, so you move slightly to your right foot. Sorry. And you move, so sorry. This is ridiculous. Which way are you going anyway? You going that way? Fine. Actually, that's the way I was thinking of going. So, and you get yourself into a conversation, you call that civilization. It means that you don't enact your desire immediately. You've kind of repressed it in various ways. You're not satisfying your, in this case, erotic desire right away, but you're finding a roundabout way to go about it. And it involves an awful lot of communication and language and diversionary tactics. And, you know, you probably have done something similar at some point. But it follows here that our civilization, therefore, our very social being, is based upon the fact that we repress our desires. For Freud, the initial repression concerned what he called the family romance. And behind that was the story of the Oedipus complex. Now, the story of the Oedipus complex is one you probably know. The male child desires his mother as his sexual object, but the male child cannot have the mother because there's a rival in town for the mother's affection, and that rival is called the father. The father represents for the male child the threat of castration. If you enact your desires, I will castrate you, is what the little boy hypothetically imagines the father to be saying. The little boy feels his desire located in his loins, as it were. It's an erotic desire. And that's exactly what's going to be attacked by the father. And how does the little boy know this? Because the little boy's looked at his big sister and sees that the same thing has happened to her. And that's why she's a big sister without the appurtenances that the little boy has. She has been, obviously, at some point, the little boy, in this version of the story, the little boy thinks, obviously, at some point, she had the same desires as me. She did desire the mother, and look what happened to her. It was chopped off by him. So I better actually go easy on this. So the Oedipal complex. The Oedipal complex also is based upon the story of Oedipus, which you probably know. Yeah, are you familiar with the story of Oedipus? Oedipus is born to Laius and Jocasta, Jocasta the mother, Laius the father, and they take the child to the oracle, and they're hoping to get, you know, a sense of what the child's future is, and the oracle says, bad news. This is a terrible, terrible condition. I don't know how to tell you this, but I'm going to tell you that this child will marry his mother and will kill his father. And Laius and Jocasta think, blimey, that's not quite what we were hoping for. And they think, what are we going to do? We can't allow this to happen. And the first thought is, well, we have to kill the child. But how do you kill your own child? Well, you can't. So they take the child up to a mountainside and decide to leave the child there, far, far away from where they live, hoping that the child will, you know, never actually come back to kill the father and fall in love with and marry the mother. As they're walking away, they think, hang on a second, the child might crawl after us. We better make sure the child isn't. So they go back and they nail the child to the mountainside. They pierce the child's foot and pin the child to the mountainside, and then they go away. And they think, well, okay, we're okay. Terrible, but we're okay, and we're feeling terrible, sad, and so on. A shepherd comes by a little while later, unplugs the baby from the mountainside, takes care of the baby, and the baby grows up. And one meaning of Oedipus is club-footed, lame, club-footed. Oedipus has a club foot because he's been nailed to the mountainside. Many, many years later, Oedipus is on his way to a big city. And on his way, he comes to a crossroads, and there's a person blocking the path. And he gets kind of irritated and gets into a fight with this person and kills the person. And of course, the person who's blocked his path is none other than Laius, his father. And he doesn't know this yet. And he wanders on and goes into the city where he falls in love with a woman who turns out to be nothing other than Jocasta, his mother. He doesn't know it's Jocasta. They have children, and eventually Oedipus finds out the terrible story of what he's done, and he plucks his eyes out, as you would do in such a situation. You think, oh, blimey, better pluck my eyes out. So that's what he does. That story gives Freud the basic structure of the family romance, and he basically suggests that that set of drives that is conditioned, first of all, within the family, which is our first unit of socialization and civilization, and also the first site in which we learn to manage our sexualities, that is the site in which we will find the roots of our psychoanalytic conditions. So the little child represses desire, but the desire doesn't go away. It returns later in various ways. So where do the repressed desires go? The short answer is they go into this, let's call it a place, called the unconscious. They go into the unconscious. That's to say, we forget that we had such desires. We eliminate our memory of those desires from our consciousness. They're not part of our daily conscious thinking. However, they will not stay in the unconscious. They're desires, after all. They are drives, and they are driven to find their way back into articulation. They will not stay in the unconscious, but rather they return frequently to embarrass us in things that we know as slips of the tongue or slips of the pen, parapraxis, as Freud called it. A slip of the tongue, a slip of the pen, or a fantasy, or a dream, things over which we don't have quite as much control. And those, when those things return, I mean, the slip of the tongue, it's important to understand that slips of the tongue don't operate the way they do in, as it were, popular culture. The slip of the tongue in popular culture is the one that goes something like, somebody walks into the room and you say, I'm really disappointed, I'm really glad to see you. And the person walking in thinks, she nearly said disappointed. Maybe she really means she's disappointed to see me and not glad to see me. That's not how parapraxis works. Parapraxis works, I gave you a hint of this last week, it works very indirectly. It works by things like stuttering, stammering, finding the wrong word, not quite saying what you mean, but also not revealing in the words directly that you use, like in that case the word disappointed, not revealing in that the truth. There's simply something else going on here, which is much, much more complicated when you do this parapraxis. Freud concentrates in particular on dreams, as you probably know. And he defines a dream as the fulfillment of a wish. A dream, he says, is the fulfillment of a wish. It's a wish that cannot be satisfied in reality or in our conscious waking life. And this is the first and most important aspect of psychoanalysis as it affects literary criticism. Our language, let's call it our dream, our poem, our text, this language potentially contains an excess of meaning. It has, as it were, an unconscious running alongside what it is consciously proposing to you as linguistic formulation. The repressed desire returns in the form of linguistic error when the unconscious breaks out into the consciousness. It need not be a linguistic error either. It can just be a linguistic oddity, something like a metaphor. It's very peculiar, if you think about it seriously, to utter a metaphor like the king is a lion. If you hear that literally, if I say to you, the king is a lion, and we forget the fact that we're well acquainted with that as a metaphor, you are likely to say, that's a kind of peculiar thing to say. Because the king doesn't have four big paws, a big mane, and growl a lot. Well, I mean, he might. But as a general rule, it's a peculiar way to think about the king. But the metaphor as such is something that contains within itself some notion of a repressed desire. What that desire might be, I don't know yet. I would need to listen to you as a Freudian analyst while you talked about what you thought about kings, what you thought about lions, and maybe you think lions are adorable, big, ugly, big, affable cats. Or you might think lions are, I said the word ugly a moment ago, didn't I? You might think that lions are big, ugly cats. You might think the king is an ugly fellow, and that's what you're about. I won't know what you're thinking in that metaphor unless and until you start freely associating with the words that you have used. So I'll ask you, kings, huh? And you might think, actually, decks of cards, that's where kings come up. And I lost a lot of money last night at poker because the person opposite me had a pair of kings and I only had a pair of jacks. 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 Toilets. I need to go to the toilet. And I used to want to go to the toilet, but my father kept stopping me, and it was part of the house training. And actually, my father behaved a bit like a king, and so on. When you do that kind of free association, then the analyst can find out what that metaphor might mean for you. In other words, what it is that you have repressed in order to make it possible for you to say the words, the king is a lion. As with a metaphor, so with all poetry. Think of poetry as the site of the manipulations of language in all sorts of unusual ways. So-called classical psychoanalysis in literary criticism takes a text, therefore, as a kind of symptom. The critic reads the text as if she were an analyst listening to a patient. And what the critic is looking out for there is anything out of the ordinary, like metaphors, metonymy, euphemism, formal disorders, all those kinds of things that the Russian formalist called the impediments to ordinary speech, remember that? Anything out of the ordinary which disturbs the smooth facade of the story that is ostensibly being proposed by the text. In classical Freudian literary analysis, the text thus becomes a kind of window upon the unconscious of its author. It's a rather dusty window, needs a bit of cleaning. You can't quite see through it, it's not very transparent, but you know that lurking behind it is the unconscious of the author. The author whose repressed desires are, despite the author, revealed by the text that she or he has written. Or they're revealed, if you like, to the careful eye of the critical reader, armed with the terminology of psychoanalytic theory. In this instance, then, psychoanalysis is quite simply a tool for interpretation. It is a hermeneutic device, as we would call it. Its assumption is that a text does not say what it means, but rather that it contains and represses a covert meaning through a kind of censorship. The consciousness cannot bear to reveal the desire which has been repressed, and so tries to censor it. And in trying to censor it, it malforms the representation of it. The desire is still there, and it's still active, and hence it reveals itself despite the conscious speaker or writer, but, and this is the crucial point, of course, it reveals itself in very indirect ways. The task of this kind of critic in Freudian analysis, the classical version of Freudian analysis, is to interpret the text as if it were like a dream. So texts operate in the same way as dreams, and you know how peculiar it is. Somebody tells you their dream that they had last night, and what do you do when somebody tells you their dream? You try to interpret it and find out something fundamental about them. If you're a Freudian analyst, you won't do anything very active. You will just let the words reverberate, have a kind of percussive effect, be suggestive, and from that a meaning may emerge, the meaning being, in this case, the repressed desires that are not immediately apparent at the front of the text. So for Freud, there's an important distinction to be made between the overt layer of a text, or let's call it a dream now, the overt layer, that's to say the bit that you see, let's call it the dream content, which is what he called it, an important distinction to be made between the overt layer and the covert layer, which he says is the real dream thought. The dream thought doesn't reveal itself immediately. If it did, it would kind of disturb you. It's a dream that says, I want to kill my father and marry my mother, for example. And that's a wee bit disturbing. So instead of having a dream about killing your father and marrying your mother, you have a dream about being a cowboy somewhere in the Wild West. And you walk into a saloon, and in the saloon, there's a prostitute standing at the bar. And the prostitute says, do you want a drink? And you say, I'll have a bourbon. And you say it in a John Wayne accent. And that takes you into a John Wayne movie. And when you're in the middle of the John Wayne movie, you think about stagecoaches. And you then start thinking about the 1930s. And you start thinking about why John Wayne went to Ireland. All that comes up in the dream. You think John Wayne, Irish, stagecoach, 1930s, the Irish Rebellion. What goes on in the process of manufacturing a dream, says Freud, is that you will have a dream thought which cannot reveal itself because of the hell's teeth, because it's too disturbing. Sorry. Right. I'll try not to dance too much around this wire. You get the dream thought, then you get the dream content. This is the stuff that we see, the stuff that you will narrate as your dream. To get there, the dream thought has to go through a process of dream work. Your unconscious works on the dream. And it works by a process that he calls condensation and displacement. And I'm going to explain that in a little bit of detail in a moment. But fundamentally, the narratives that constitute the dream content is not actually what the dream's about. The dream is about the dream thought. So in exactly the same way, we would say, if we were classic Freudian analysts of a literary text, the content of the poem is not what the poem is about. Lurking behind that somewhere, there is a poem thought. And we have to get at that poem thought by analysing, which just means separating out, that's what the word analysis means, to separate out the business of the dream work. How is it that the dream content gets represented in this way? And how is it that the dream thought has been misrepresented to get it to this particular kind of condition? The dream work converts dream thoughts into dream stories. It translates the thoughts into those narratives and crazy events that flash past us in the night. The dream work operates with two major tools, condensation and displacement. And these work in very particular ways for Freud. Condensation works to avoid the censor, or the psychic censors in this case, by a kind of indirection and association. The dream thought articulates itself at the level of the dream content by making one image, say, stand for a number of different mental counters or elements. And in displacement, the dream is differently centered, as Freud has it, from the dream thoughts. Let me give you a little bit of a dream here, if I can find it, from the interpretation of dreams. This is the dream of the botanical monograph, is what he calls it. When you pick up the interpretation of dreams, you will find the index of dreams in it, and this is the one called the dream of the botanical monograph. Here's the content of the dream. I had written a monograph on an unspecified genus of plant. The book lay before me, and I was at the moment turning over a folded coloured plate. Bound up in the copy, there was a dried specimen of the plant. Okay, so that's the dream. That's the content of the dream. Here comes the analysis. The element in this dream which stood out most was the botanical monograph, he says. This arose from the impressions of the dream day. In other words, what I'd been doing during the conscious period before this dream. I had, in fact, seen a monograph on the genus Cyclamen in the window of a bookshop. There was no mention of this genus in the content of the dream. All that was left in it was the monograph and its relation to botany. The botanical monograph immediately revealed its connection with the work upon cocaine, which I had once written. So that's his association. He thinks about this and thinks, the work upon cocaine, botany, cocaine, fine, coca plant. From cocaine, the chains of thought led on the one hand to a Festschrift that he's involved in and to certain events in a university laboratory, and on the other hand to my friend Dr. Koenigstein, the eye surgeon, who had had a share in the introduction of cocaine. Let me jump a little bit. As I perceived, the botanical monograph in the dream turned out to be what he calls an intermediate common entity between two experiences of the previous day. One, the seeing the thing in the bookshop window, and two, a meeting that he'd had with Dr. Koenigstein. So these two things get coalesced in this particular monograph. So the monograph is not a botanical monograph. It is something that has condensed together at least these two items. Not only the compound idea botanical monograph, however, but each of its components, botanical and monograph, separately, led by numerous connecting paths deeper and deeper into the tangle of dream thoughts. Botanical, now listen to what happens here, botanical was related to the figure of Professor Gärtner. It's Gardner, that's the German word for Gardner. So the botanical monograph relates to somebody called Professor Gardner. The blooming looks of his wife, to my patient Flora, and to the lady, Frau L, of whom I had told the story of the forgotten flowers the previous day. Gärtner led in turn to the laboratory and to my conversation with Königstein. My two patients, Flora and Frau L, had been mentioned in the course of this conversation. A train of thought joined the lady with the flowers to my wife's favourite flowers, and then to the title of the monograph, which I had seen for a moment during the day. In addition to these, botanical recalled an episode at my secondary school and an examination while I was at the university. And so it goes on. All of these associations for Freud are contained within, compressed within, or condensed within the word botanical. At one level, then, the word botanical contains multiple layers of what could be in the dream thought. The dream thought is all this stuff. It gets worked upon to give you, in the dream content, the word botanical and a monograph. So your task as an analyst, when you read the dream of the botanical monograph, is to work your way back to the dream thought. But you work your way back by realizing that the word botanical operates by condensation. And condensation we can now think of as what it actually is, metaphor. A metaphor is the thing that collapses two things together and identifies them, compresses two things together, condenses the language of the jungle and the language of monarchy, for example. It condenses them together. Displacement means that the actual thought gets displaced onto something else entirely. It works like, as Lacan will say in a moment, metonymy. Metonymy, unlike metaphor, doesn't compress things together. A metonymy is something that will take, let me give you an example of a metonymy. The White House says that we will not bomb Iran. Well now, in that sentence, you know what I mean. I mean not the White, because the White House doesn't speak. The President says that we will not bomb Iran. What I do to make a metonymy is to take something that is adjacent to the president, in this case the White House, and substitute that for the president himself. Metonymy works by a process of adjacency, displacement, moving things to the side, as it were. The task, you've got some of this on the handout, and I'm not going to delay us to go through this, but it's got on the Freud bits of the handout, but I'll leave you to read that yourself. The task here, therefore, is a task of interpretation that reveals a repression that has been made covert, but to which we can get access by an analysis of the dream work, the process by which the dream thought has been translated into the dream content. And that involves primarily, in Freudian analysis, the work of condensation and the work of displacement. Let me shift on, since I've begun to talk a little bit about language now, to Lacan, Jacques Lacan. And in particular here, I want to talk about the relation, the way that Lacan uses psychoanalysis to make problematic for us the notion of language and the subject of a speech, the subject of a speech act, the thing that says I. Lacan rereads Freud in the light of structuralist linguistics. So cast your mind back to structuralist linguistics, Saussure and all that stuff that we did a few weeks ago. Because crucially, what he does is to add the work of Saussure to the work of Jacobson and to the terminology of Freud. Most famously, he argues that the unconscious of which Freud wrote is, and I quote, structured like a language. The unconscious is structured like a language. If you want to understand the unconscious, you have to be able to understand the operations of language, and it works therefore rather like, you remember the things we talked about, the langue and the parole in relation to Saussure, where you're trying to get to the langue that underlies the parole, the individual speech acts in structuralist linguistics. For him, then, condensation and displacement are, pretty unproblematically, analogous to the linguistic operations of metaphor and metonymy. And remember, Jakobson also talked about how any speech act goes in two different directions at once. It goes, as it were, progressively with words adjacent to each other, and he calls that the axis of metonymy. Let's now call it the axis of displacement. And within each speech act, the words chosen, the words selected from what he calls the axis of selection or the axis of metaphor, is here the axis of condensation, because each word contains within itself a trace of the words that it could have been but aren't. Cast your mind back to what I said in the work on Jakobson. Lacan rethinks Freud's Oedipus complex also in linguistic terms as well, such that the negotiation of the complex becomes analogous for Lacan to what he calls the entry into language. As he points out, we're not all born fluently speaking the kind of language that we learn to speak. We have to enter into language. And for Lacan, this is exactly that process of acculturation and socialization that we get seen in Freud, but in Freud it's told in the version of the Oedipus complex. If you think about the Oedipus complex and what it actually means, here I am, I'm a wee boy, and I want to marry my mother and have babies with my mother. What does that actually mean? At one level it means I want to be the father of myself, and I'll kill the father to get rid of him in order to become the father of myself. And what does that mean? It means I want to be autonomous. I want to be the origin of myself. I don't want to be answerable to that which has gone before. I simply want to be somebody who is beginning himself, being the author of himself. I want to be the father of myself. I don't want to be descended from. I want to be the beginning of something. I want to initiate something. Another word for initiation. I want to authorize something. I want to be the author of my own being. So for Lacan, the negotiation of the Oedipal complex is actually rather like the entry into language, where you can start to authorize your own statements. For Lacan, the period before the cracking of the Oedipus complex, as it were, before you actually manage to negotiate it, is the pre-Oedipal stage, and he calls it the mirror stage. On the back end of your handout, I've given you a kind of diagrammatic representation of Freud mapping onto Lacan here. So have that in front of you as I'm going through this bit here. So for Lacan, the pre-Oedipal stage is the mirror stage. And the mirror stage is the stage in which the child identifies itself with an image of itself. Not necessarily in a mirror, just an image outside of itself. Seeing itself in a mirror or reflected in some image outside of itself, it might be the mother's breast, it might be the wardrobe, I don't really care what it is. But the child sees itself reflected in some image outside of itself. And in doing so, the child forms an identification of itself with this image, or imaginary, as Lacan will call it. That's to say, the child focuses on images and not on objects themselves as a comfort and a reassurance of the child's own wholeness. The ego, the thing that is able to say I, is now constituted through this identification with imaginary projections, says Lacan. At some point, however, the child grows up, or, as Lacan has it, goes through the mirror stage and meets what Lacan calls the law of the father, all that castration stuff in Freud. In Lacan, going through the mirror stage leads to the realization that the subject cannot be entirely whole and present to itself. And this is also the moment of the acquisition of language, because Lacan believes that language depends upon difference. He gets this from Saussure. It's a fundamental concept derived from Saussurean linguistics, remember, that where there is difference, there is the possibility of a language, and that language works by a system of differences, oppositions that have no positive terms. So in entering to this particular stage, where the subject realizes that it is different from other things, the subject can get its identity. In other words, it can begin to say, I. But more importantly, what we're discovering is that the possibility of linguistic distinction is now available. But the first thing the child realizes is that in saying the word I, the child is not contained within that word I. The child is fractured, the child's subjectivity is fractured, broken, not present to itself, partially contained in these imaginary representations that it had before it entered language, but also now partially displaced onto other possible subject positions for itself. So I no longer equals or identifies itself with I. I am not myself, as we would maybe put it. The self is fractured or fissured. On the one hand, to put it very, very simply, you experience yourself as being, look in a mirror and what happens. You experience yourself as being here, but at the same time as being here, you're also aware of the fact that you are there in the mirror, and you're not quite, on the one hand, that's undeniably it's you. It might be bad news, but nonetheless, it's undeniable it is you in the mirror. Yet at the same time, you know that you're not there, you're here. So what constitutes I in that situation? The I is fractured, fissured, unsure of where it stands, quite simply. Hence, we get a famous revision of Descartes. Remember Descartes? I think, therefore I am. Here is Lacan revising Descartes. Instead of I think, therefore I am, he says, I am not where I think. I am not where I think. And I think where I am not. So it's not I think, therefore I am. It's not as simple as that, because that presupposes an identification between the two I's in that sentence. I think, therefore I am. For Lacan, that I cannot be present to itself. I am not where I think. So whatever I'm thinking, that is not me. Okay, the I is always somewhere else. That fracturing of subjectivity is absolutely central now to Lacanian psychoanalysis. Whereas for Freudian analysis, it was possible to construct a kind of psychobiography of an individual author, in Lacanian analysis, that author is constantly decentered. The author that you're analysing has no self, in fact, has no subject, is nothing other than a fleeting instantiation of subjectivity. The author is, if you like, constantly decentered or displaced. Freudians are on the lookout for the occasional parapraxis that disturbs the otherwise smooth flow of language. Okay? And that assumes that there is a smooth flow of language in which the consciousness is determining what is being said. For Lacan, there is no such straightforward, smooth flowing of language. Everything is parapraxis. Everything is shaped by the unconscious that is structured like a language and that is determining what it is that can be said. It's a little bit like saying the entire text is all parapraxis. It's all a slip of the tongue. It's all a slip of the pen. You never know where you stand in relation to it, and you never know who the author is. So the text for Lacanians is always radically decentered. Its center of meaning is elsewhere. You can't go in Lacanian analysis from the dream content back to a determining dream thought the way you can in Freudian analysis. Freud proposed that his analysis was potentially interminable. For Lacan, it's absolutely radically interminable. You can never arrive at some kind of final determining instance that says, here is the meaning of this dream content. By analogy, in textual analysis, you can never get to the point where you can say, this is the meaning of this particular poem or text. So the text for Lacanians is always radically decentered, and much more important for general purposes, so is the I that wrote the text. The I that wrote the text is also always decentered. Shakespeare is not who you thought Shakespeare was. Milton is not who you thought Milton was. But logically, it follows also that the I that is reading the text is not present to itself either. So you're not who you think you are. And that's quite a destabilizing and worrying proposition. I don't know who I am. But think about what that actually is saying. What that is saying for the first time, actually, is that I'm aware of my unconscious. Because if you take the presence of the unconscious seriously, you go back to what I was satirizing at the beginning, is that Donald Rumsfeld position of the unknown unknowns. You simply don't know who you are because you don't know fully and totally the content of your unconscious. If you did, it wouldn't be unconscious, it would be conscious. But the fact that you're acknowledging your unconscious means that now, radically, you are decentered from yourself. You don't know who you are. And that has huge implications for you taking a theoretical stance. It has huge implications for those of you who, over the last 2 weeks, wanted to take a political stance, to identify yourselves clearly as a Marxist or as a feminist or some other political position. If you can't know who you are, then it becomes rather difficult to occupy a stable political position. Interpretation here is something that is radically endless because, and here's another phrase from Lacan, the unconscious is the discourse of the other. What he means by that is the unconscious is what takes you into realizing that your self is always other than itself. It's always other than you think it is. Likewise for the author that you're analyzing. So the notion of identity in Lacan is radically fractured, as is also the notion of an author having certain properties or qualities, things that are propre to the author herself or himself. There are huge implications, obviously, for textual analysis in this. That's all problematic. Before I go on to Bloom, let me talk you through the last little bit of that diagram that I've given you on the handout, where I've got Freud at one end, Lacan in the middle, and Kristeva on the other. What I've done here is to try to show you that in Freud we've got the two stages, the pre-Oedipal and the post-Oedipal, and in the middle of that you go through the Oedipal complex. In Lacan, that gets mapped onto a different structure. The structure of the pre-Oedipal is what he calls the imaginary, where there is no unconscious, and he describes that as a reactionary position and a conservative one. In Lacan, you go through the mirror stage, not the Oedipal complex, and you arrive at the symbolic order, which is what we usually call language. The entry into the symbolic order is the entrance into language. But to get there, you have to repress things. You therefore produce the unconscious as you're entering into language. But you produce the unconscious as something that is structured like a language, and it's lying there repressed. For Kristeva, remember, I pointed out last week the importance for her of two stages, the stage of the semiotic and the symbolic. The symbolic order for her is one which is marked by order, by, if you like, the manifest content of a literary text. But the semiotic is what is, as it were, pre-linguistic, pre-symbolic. It's that order that she associates with the kora, which I'm translating in this here loosely as the womb. It's all those kind of pulsions, bodily sensations, rhythms, and so on that can't be articulated directly in semantics or the symbolic order, but remain within the semiotic. Now, for her, the semiotic occupies a position that's analogous to the imaginary in Lacan. But for Lacan, the imaginary is reactionary and conservative, whereas for Kristeva, the semiotic is profoundly revolutionary because it's anarchic. These are huge differences, then, between Kristeva and Lacan, although the structure of things is the same. Running alongside the middle here, I've got this notion of an agon, which is simply a word for a conflict, and I take that from Harold Bloom, about whom I'm now going to speak. Harold Bloom has often been associated with deconstruction, but he is not, never has been, a deconstructor. In fact, he writes against deconstruction. He loathes it. But because he worked at Yale University at a time when there were four other people who were associated with deconstruction, Jacques Derrida, Paul DeMann, Geoffrey Hartman, and J. Hillis Miller, he was kind of identified with them. They put a book out together called Deconstruction and Criticism, and Bloom said afterwards, they were deconstruction, I was criticism. And what he's trying to do is to make a big distinction between his position and theirs in deconstruction. And I'll speak about deconstruction when we come back after the vacation. He sees deconstruction as a critical blind alley. In fact, he's a fairly straightforward Freudian, especially in all his key determining work in the last two decades of the 20th century. What he sees is a history of literature in which writers are engaged essentially in a series of Oedipal struggles. How do you become a poet, he asks? Well, you become a poet because you feel the urge to write something. Why do you feel the urge to write something? Because you've been reading poetry. There's no, I mean, you wouldn't do it otherwise. And if you are, for example, Seamus Heaney, you sit down one day and you've been reading an awful lot of Ted Hughes. And when Seamus Heaney was asked how he became a poet, he said in an interview, well, I've been reading all this stuff by Ted Hughes. And I kind of thought, I think I can do something like that. So I'll have a go. So he writes things. And some of them are a wee bit like Ted Hughes. And he reads more and he remembers more about his own intellectual formation. And he thinks back to the great Irish poet, Yeats. And he thinks, actually, I think I can do some of the stuff that Yeats was trying to do. And so he tries to write poetry. When he reads that poetry, he realizes that Yeats has got there first, that he looks like second-rate Yeats. So what he's got to do, says Bloom, is to enter into this Freudian struggle with the precursor, this Oedipal struggle. Yeats is his father figure. He's got to get Yeats out of the way to make space for himself, to author himself. But how did Yeats become a poet? Well, he'd been reading Shelley and Blake. How did Shelley become a poet? Well, Shelley had been reading lots of people, but behind Blake, there is Milton. Well, how did Milton become a poet? Well, Milton had read the Hebrew Bible, and so on. You get this endless chain that goes back to some mythical beginning at some point. So for Bloom, the problem for writers is that the great books have all been written. As the great man Bob Dylan once said, actually, the great books have all been written, I don't want to write one. All that's available for the poet who comes along now, the poet who feels herself or himself to be belated with respect to the tradition, all that's available is revision. Revision of the previous tradition of poetry. And Bloom argues that the new poet, that he calls the Ephebe poet from the Greek, is she or he who comes along, realises that she has to struggle against a strong forerunner, a precursor poet, as he calls it, in a manner that's extremely akin to Oedipus's struggle with the father, to knock the father out of the way. No poet can write in isolation from her or his predecessor, whose greatness, or law, is assumed, as in the law of the father. But the strong poet, for Bloom, is she or he who achieves a kind of emancipation from this law, formulating their own law. In other words, becoming precursors themselves of future generations. You, as a poet now, would dearly like, I'm sure, to be second-rate Heaney, first of all. And once you've, as it were, become second-rate Heaney, then you can become first-rate whoever you are. But you're going to have to get Heaney out of the way in some kind of way. Here, in this process, there has to be an act of crucial repression in the poetry of the strong poet. The strong poet must repress their prior dependence upon the strong precursor. You have to hide it in some kind of way. And this they do through what Bloom calls six revisionary ratios. And he structures a whole map, as he calls it, a map of misreading, which you've got on your handout. You'll find that map explained in detail in his book, A Map of Misreading. But fundamentally what's at stake here is that if I'm coming along to write a poem, and I write a poem and I think it looks like second-rate Heaney, what I have to do to make a space for myself is to misread Heaney, to somehow show that Heaney was about something else completely, and that when I'm writing a poem about my mother standing in the kitchen baking bread with her hands all floury and the mud outside, then that's not Heaney, because Heaney was writing about something else, I want to say. So what I'd have to do is to write a poem that certainly will learn from Heaney, because there's no getting away from the fact that I am the descendant of Heaney, but that has to misread Heaney or to misrepresent Heaney in a particular kind of way, thus making a space for yourself. It's a wee bit like waking up one morning and realising that you're turning into your father, that your hairstyle's the same as your father's. So you start combing it from the other side or something to make yourself look different from the father. And suddenly the father changes as well. When you do that, the father is no longer your father anymore. You've changed the relation between the two. You have rewritten the past. That's all you can do as a poet, says Bloom. And the strong poet is she or he who faces up to that fact and engages in one or more of these six revisionary ratios that I've given you. Clinamen, tessera, kenosis, demonization, ascesis, and apophrodes. These six very structured ways of deviating from the tradition that you've inherited. Clinamen involves what he calls a swerve away from the precursor poet. It implies that the precursor poem was right up to a point, but it should have swerved precisely at the moment when the Ephebe, the new poet, swerves. Tessera, he also calls antithetical completion, is done by reading the parent poem, the earlier poem, in a way that retains the terms of that earlier poem, but creatively misreads them, implying, therefore, that the precursor has not fully understood what it is that she or he was writing, and therefore has not gone far enough. Kenosis, he defines as an emptying out and a reduction of the content of both poems, a weakening of your own poem and of the precursor poem. Demonization is what happens when you write a poem that hides the singularity of the precursor poem, that shows that the precursor poem was just one of a whole series of poems that predate your poetry. So it generalizes away the singularity of the parent poem by referring to a range of poetry which you are now claiming was beyond the precursor, but that you, the new poet, have available to you. Ascesis, he defines as purgation, in which the new poet yields up a part of her imaginative powers, thus separating herself from all other poets, including the precursor poet, but to do that in such a way as again to change the meaning of the precursor poem, to make that undergo an ascesis or purgation as well. And finally, Apophrodis is the most radical of these. Apophrodis means the return of the dead, and it makes it appear as if the precursor poems are actually imitations of the new poem, the new poet. In all of these things, the one crucial thing that is running behind all this is the realization that we begin to think about a little time ago when we talked about various other aspects of what was happening at the period of high modernism. If you think about this, when you write a poem now, if you're a Bloomian poet, and if Bloom is right, then what you're doing when you're writing the poem is two things. You're writing a poem, but you're writing a criticism of earlier poetry. Your poem is a critical act as well as a creative act. And what Bloom does is to destabilize the relation between the creative act and the critical act. It follows also that criticism is a form of poetry. And if you think about this in those terms, you begin to realize that you're all students of English and creative writing, regardless of what degree you're actually doing, because in these terms, as a critic, you are also a poet. And on that cheerful note, I shall leave you to write a lot of poetry over the Christmas vacation, or a lot of criticism, because they're both the same thing. And I'll see you then on the Monday, the first day of next term, when you will have got over all your celebrations, if you celebrate and mark the turning of the calendar year, and you'll come back refreshed, invigorated, and ready and raring to go with deconstruction. Deconstruction, which is quite difficult, but well worth it. Thanks for your attention today, and enjoy a good vacation. Work hard.